In today's episode,
the virtuous motivation out of all this, well, just from a pragmatic standpoint, well, the audience is made up of lots of people too.
Yeah, of course.
Like,
yeah.
It's not, you know, so like just this idea that, you know, certain people were going to be the culture makers. And that's, you know, since then, it's just completely been blown up, that idea, which
100%.
Which is awesome.
Well, it's moving in that direction at least. Yeah, for sure. Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. I have a very special guest here today, James DiGiulio, founder of Tongo. Welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thank you. Thanks, Bilal. Thanks for having me on here.
You've got that kind of beautiful blurred background going, but just to paint a picture of where you are right now. Yeah, exactly. I just have like a wall behind me with this famous plant by this point, but yeah, I know the feeling. But yeah, you're actually based in California, right? So we're going to be talking a lot about entertainment and Hollywood and the future of it today. So I just want to paint a picture where you are.
Mine is definitely an LA story, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to get...
It's definitely a main character in this novel, I'll tell you.
Yeah, got it. Well, listen, man. So Tongo is a company I've been aware of for many, many years. I think you've been around for like 14 years or so by this point. But when I worked at Google, we would work with you guys when brands would come to us and say, we want to create content for YouTube, we want to create video ads, where should we go? And that was always a problem that kept coming up over and over again. And a lot of the time we would say, hey, we're not allowed to actually, you know, recommend people like agencies and stuff, but a lot of people are using this thing called Tongo. Check it out. If it works for you, great. If not, then don't blame us, sort of thing, you know? But a lot of them did use it.
I appreciate it. You know, I can't say I'm going to send you a commission check, but I appreciate
talk about that at the end. But yeah, so before we go into the nuts and bolts of that, that was my impression of it from the outside. But as this person who came up with the idea and the story or the whole company, what is Tongo for someone who's never heard of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there are now words to describe what we're doing. You know, I felt like I was a little bit very, like you said, the company's been around for 14 years and I wouldn't describe it as having been fully operational for 14 years. But, you know, now I think we're pretty far out ahead of a lot of the trends in both the marketplace of content and creation and everything around that. But also psychologically a little bit out ahead. So you know, now there are words to describe what we do. So like we've really been building, you know, decentralized creator community for, you know, for 14 years now, and doing so in a really unique way. Like we've really gone out and deliberately built like highly professional network of creators. And I've lived through MCN, I've lived through influencer, and we've really just locked in on this idea that we can create the studio of the future through networking the right people with the right talent and organizing them into an opportunity flow. So we've really, you know, when I think about Tongo, it's really, you know, we've really built a very powerful creator community.
Yeah, I know what you mean about kind of being when you're ahead of the curve and you don't have a name for it yet. Like I see that time and time again with some of the people I meet, because you're seeing like the actual use case and you're like, well, there's people on Instagram and YouTube and all these creative people, and there's brands who keep asking for creative work. Later people coined a term, right? And now the two you mentioned there, creator economy is a very popular one, and decentralized we'll get to as well. A lot of people think of decentralized nowadays because of blockchain and crypto and stuff like that. But maybe we'll get onto kind of how you think about it as it relates to what you're working on. Just to give a few examples, so I know you've worked with many, many brands. You've got, I think, over 160,000 creators in your network. Or would you describe it as a marketplace, by the way?
No, I definitely wouldn't describe it as a marketplace. Like, I wish we fit. A lot of the times, like, there's a lot of gray hair on my face now. Yeah. If I had fit into a box, that would probably be a little bit different. But we just, you know, it's just one of those things where we don't fit into a box. There is definitely a marketplace dynamic that's happening in Tongo, but we're really, you know, like I said, we're really trying to build a networked studio. And part of that is the exchange of work for, you know, in a marketplace, but it's really a managed platform. So, you know, it takes creative individuals in the center who are organizing this stuff, but you know, so I wouldn't call us directly anyways.
Yeah, no, that's good. I'm glad I asked that. So, and just to paint a picture specifically of how it works, I gave an example before of how we might have used it, you know, working with brands, but it's not, you've got the creative people on one side who are actually creating content, and then you've got the people who are paying those people, I'm assuming, which are brands like Lego, NBC, Google, Spotify, PayPal, NASA, McDonald's, and many others, right?
We've got like the, you know, A-list of A-list users of the thing, which is awesome. And so it's always been, you know, it's always been my intention that the higher quality the organization that's looking for the talent, the higher quality talent we were going to attract. You know, so that was a very deliberate decision to say, let's go out and get these brands. And I mean, for the most part, what happens is one of our clients is looking for a series of creative work or a one-off piece of creative work from different people. That gets turned into sort of a community-facing RFP that may have different tasks associated with it. There may be like I hate to call it tasks, but it seems very menial, but there might be like creative opportunities that some could be just conceptualizing what to do. Some could the actual production of it, right? There could be RFPs for certain types of talent or even a food stylist in some cases. So that's what I mean. We're really trying to network. When I think about what we're doing and what's really interesting about it, I think looking forward is that this is highly sophisticated work, right? The reason why I kind of don't want to go to the marketplace. We're more of a market network than a marketplace, but the reason why I don't say, because it's these, I think of a marketplace as a very singular dimension exchange of one thing. I get you.
Very transactional,
right?
Yeah.
These are ever evolving dynamic projects that people are working on. So it's just a little bit different.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. And just to give a sense of scale, again, whatever you're able to share here, I mentioned the 160,000 creators on the platform. I saw on Crunchbase, I don't know how accurate that is nowadays, but $36 million raised in venture capital or investment anyway, up to Series D. Is that roughly accurate?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
Okay,
yeah, Crunchbase. The internet, they figured it out.
I know. I put Crunchbase in the bucket of like Wikipedia. It's like mostly right, but once in a while you'd be like, no, I raised $100 million last year. You must have missed that. So, so $36 million, obviously significant amount of money. And so is there anything on the revenue size or anything, even a range that you're able to share that the platform does?
Not really like in a position to share, but I will say we had a good year last year and the company grew more than 50%, which is we're very proud of. And I think it's speaking to what's happening in the marketplace, just in terms of the lines of the organization are getting redrawn pretty quickly. And I think, as you said earlier, the adoption of this idea of the creator as part of what you should be doing is starting to really be mainstream now.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Like we were talking about like earlier on, you know, when we were really just trying to like incubate this company, because it is like, it does have this marketplace dynamic. So you need to get creators on your platform. You need to get people who want to pay them on your platform. And we would have conversations and people would look at me like I was just fucking crazy. Like what?
Yeah.
There's a guy, you know, they work for you. I'm like, no, they don't work for me. There's somebody who's really talented. They really want to do this stuff. They're sophisticated and organized, and you have access to them in this platform. And you're like, I don't think so. It's not going to be any good. It's crap, you know?
And so, and I mentioned, you know, we used it with our clients at Google for mostly ads because that's what we were working in. But this isn't just ads. It is people creating content, like long form content, series of content. And like you said, you mentioned something about food stylists. Like those are all the levels and layers that you're working in the creative space. So is there, just to paint a picture, like an example of a best in class, you know, use case of the platform with a brand? I read something about Tongo's innovations with the Lego group, which might be an interesting one. I also saw you love talking Lego on the internet. So maybe we can talk about that one or any other ones that comes to mind.
Yeah, I think Lego's, they're a great example. And in a lot of ways, our company grew up around Lego. And look, I mean, I couldn't even believe that they took a meeting with us back then, because it was, you know, it was a lot of scotch tape and you know, trying to build something. And we barely had a company at the time. But I thought what was really interesting about the Lego story, at least when it comes to Tongle, is that, you know, there was a lot of creative energy around, there was a lot of creative energy early on around Lego on the internet. Right. There were up and coming animators making stop motion animation, even kids making stop motion animation just because they loved the brand and it was part of play, you know. And what's interesting about Lego is, like, around that time, they kind of went through the looking glass in a way and turned into, you know, they kind of became the most forward looking type of organization from a marketing standpoint, because they're out there making, you know, 2-hour commercials that gross $500 million or more, and TV shows. And it's brilliant because they've kind of crossed the line between being in a content company and a marketing organization. So that's really interesting. You know, I think the best companies have done that. Like, obviously, like Nike has done that. In a really interesting way. Right.
And so what would Lego have actually used? What did they actually create using Tongo? What were the assets, I guess, or the kind of end result in this case?
Yeah, early on, it was a lot of stop motion animation around, you know, new toys, new themes. You know, I remember being at one of the earlier Comic Cons, and, you know, there were, like, we were handing out minifigures of Captain America, or like limited edition minifigures for both DC and Marvel. And then we would have creators find out about that and then build a short film around the character they were getting at Comic-Con. So it was very much like community oriented, creator oriented, storytelling oriented, and, you know, a lot of short form content creation.
Got it. So yeah, maybe we'll revisit some of those examples a little bit later.
Sure.
But I want to take a step back for a second and talk a little bit about how you kind of got in that position in the first place, where you saw this opportunity. I mentioned you're in, you know, basically close enough to Hollywood, while you're in LA. So you before you started this company, you worked in Hollywood for a while. You were at Paramount, and many other jobs before that. Actually, one of my favorite things in prep for this interview was your LinkedIn. It goes all the way back to your student jobs. And I love that you found that.
You got to scroll all the way down.
Yeah, exactly. And I could tell, okay, this guy has some humor in him. I like that. And lighthearted stuff in there. But all jokes aside, I mean, if you think about all of our careers, those early jobs make such a big difference, right? Like working in a retail store, or working, I think you worked at like a boating club or yacht club or something like that.
Yeah. It's just, you learn so much. You know, there's a quote that I love, and I don't even know who to attribute it to. I've heard it from both. You're familiar with Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist and teacher. I've heard it from him, and I think probably I'm not going to act too highbrow, because I think I first heard it from Joe Walsh, who's the guitar player in the Eagles. But it's just this idea that, like, you know, as you live your life, when you're going into things, you're just like smashing into things and it doesn't make any sense. And it feels like it's anarchy and total chaos and random things happen. You do a random job and all this, and just, you feel like you can't really make sense of it while it's happening. But then if you stop and turn around, all of the moments, they feel like they're a part of some like finely crafted novel, right? Yeah. And so when I think like, oh, if I never did that, I would have never gotten that, and that never would have happened. It's just this interconnected series of events that happen that you set off just by, you know, just by living your life.
Yeah,
and that's the neat thing about like building something and all this, is you can say, wow, geez, if I had never met that person, if I never went to that college, or never went met that person, this would not be the same anyway, right?
Yeah, so, not 100%. Well, it reminds me a lot of, it's probably cliche by this point, but Steve Jobs' Stanford commencement speech, I don't know if you've ever seen that, but he talks about the idea of connecting the dots and how he did a calligraphy class at whatever school he was at. And then later down the road, when he started Apple, you know, they were the first to really do the typography, you know, and the GUIs and stuff like that. At that level anyway, and really make it such a thing. So yeah, it's really the connecting the dots.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah, completely. So tell me, what were you actually doing in Hollywood before you started this company?
Yeah, I have a really interesting you know, journey to get to there, which got me, you know, kind of as we're saying, got me to here. You know, if you'll indulge me for a second, a lot of, even before that, I can see the connections between why I built Tongle and the motivation behind something. You know, I grew up a kid who just loved movies. I was obsessed with, you know, especially a lot of comedies and like 80s comedies. And I was like totally in love with movies. You know, I have three sisters, and I remember, you know, like forcing them to act out in my videos and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And then, you know, look, I grew up, you know, son of first generation American, Italian Americans in Connecticut. And I like and the world is so connected now. You just like looking at watching a movie on HBO when I was, you know, 9 years old or whatever, seeing 300 credits at the end of the I never knew anybody. I never thought anybody could actually do that for a living. It just didn't seem real. Right. And then when I went off to college, I still had these passions, but I got into which I had a great experience in college. I got into school, and there were no filmmaking. There was one filmmaking class. Actually, that's not true. There was one filmmaking class. There was 10 people in the class every semester, and it was determined by lottery. So I like literally just never had the way like you take it for granted that like my kids can do almost anything with, filmmaking related, because they have access to technology and education and YouTube and everywhere across the world. There just was no access to it. So I sort of fell in. I went to work on Wall Street. I have no idea how I did that. I have no idea why anybody would ever hire me in an investment bank. So I went to work at Lehman Brothers.
I saw that. Yeah.
And, I didn't really fit in, but I had a good time. And I just didn't see that as my path. I just didn't see, you know, and interestingly enough, I had the chance to put my hands on like a very early internet product, and it was just, you know, kind of off to the side. But at some point I had enough. I quit that job, moved to California. And I was like, look, I'm going to go do this. I'm finally going to go do it. And I got out here, and I couldn't get a job. I literally could not. I went from like having something my mother would go to cocktail parties and talk about, you know, what her son was doing. It was very easy to explain. And I got to Hollywood, and I couldn't get a job. I literally, like, no one would hire me.
But what did you study, by the way, before that?
I was an economics major.
Yeah, similar to me. Yeah. I know what you mean, because I did a very small stint at like Citibank for, you know, like an internship essentially. And it was the reason I bring it up is because sometimes it teaches you what you don't want to do. And other people now have spent 30 years in their career just that in the banking industry because they just fell into it. And then you don't ever think to change it, you know. So I think sometimes it's a blessing to do that kind of early and realize you don't actually want to do it in the first place.
Totally. And I was never really like the things that motivated that stuff never interested me in school. It just never did. I was all in on literature and English and philosophy and, you know, all those things, history. But it's like, the world was just different.
Banking pays,
like,
man.
You got to, at some point you're like, you just borrowed all this money to go to this college.
Yeah.
And pay
yeah.
Back
yeah.
At
it
some
makes
point,
sense.
Dude. So you're like, all right. So, you know, and I got on here, I worked as hard as I could to build my network. No one would hire me. And so Mark Burrell, my Tongle co-founder, he had gotten a job through just a series of good events. And there was this thing called the Hollywood Creative Directory. And this before, like, and it literally had listed, you know, every production company, every studio in there with their contact information.
It's kind of like Yellow Pages, but specifically for that. Well,
yeah, it really makes me feel old, but that's the way it was. And so I went through it, and I said, well, if I can't, no one will pay me, who will hire me for free? Who would I choose to work for? Right. And, the first name on the list was this guy named Robert Evans, who, was a like legendary Hollywood maverick. There was a show they just did on, Paramount Plus about the making of The Godfather.
And like, oh,
this
yeah,
is like
I heard
part
about
of
it.
It's like really, it's yeah. great. It's great.
Yeah, and this guy I heard someone talk like, about it on podcast and added it to my list, but I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, you have to. And this guy's like an all-time Hollywood legend, you know, produced The Godfather, Chinatown, like all these 70s movie classics. And when I got to Hollywood, the culty thing to have was his audio book on tape. It's called The Kid Stays in the Picture. And I totally fell in love with this guy's story. If you haven't listened to it, I absolutely highly recommend you go on Audible and download
yeah, definitely.
It. And so I was totally upset. He was the first name on my list. So I called up his office and they wouldn't hire me for free. And so I was like, all right, well, who would I do next? And the next name on my list was Harold Ramis, who I don't know if you know who Harold Ramis is, but, you know, he was like, remember the Ghostbusters? He was Egon, you know, the guy with the glasses.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
And, but one of the most brilliant comedy writers and directors of all time, like his resume goes from Animal House to, you know, to he directed Caddyshack and then ultimately Groundhog Day, which, you know, people think is like his magnum opus, which is, you know, brilliant.
Oh yeah. Movies. Brilliant. Yeah.
So, you know, they said, sure, come on down. So I like would go to like the Fox lot where they had an office. And, you know, that's where I learned to read scripts and do coverage and kind of, you know, break into the business. And then one day, oddly enough, a friend of mine was like, hey, did you see that there's a job at Robert Evans's company? And I was like, no, really? And I like wrote him a personal letter. And for whatever reason, again, they hired me. And I remember looking through the like resumes of people they didn't hire. And it was like, you know, people who went to Harvard Law School and stuff. I'm like, what you want me for this job? Great. You know? And well, so that's what, how I really
just
got,
curious
I got
to
my
go
foot
into
in the
that.
Door, yeah.
What do you think he might have seen? I'm sure you've spoken to him a lot since then. So, or the people who were hiring you, what do you think stood out? Was it like the letter you wrote? Was it something that was so specific in the way that you had positioned yourself? Because I think right now, unfortunately, we're going through a recession and a lot of people are getting laid off.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if there's anything there that might be helpful for someone.
You know, I just didn't follow the same route to getting the job as everybody else.
Yeah.
And I think that's, there's no, I get calls from people all the time, like, how do I break into the entertainment business? And the hard thing for everyone is there's no roadmap for that, right? There's different strategies you could have to break in and become successful, but there's no, it's not like, okay, well, if you go and you study biology and you get above a 3.9 GPA, and then you decide you're going to take you're going to go to graduate school and be a doctor. And like, then there's just a series of hurdles that are well-defined for people. Entertainment business just doesn't operate that way.
Yeah.
It's literally like
you got to find a way to stand out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was there for a while, and that's where I equate that to my business school. That was like me, you know, how I learned the business, how I learned, you know, I was really passionate about it. But at some point, like time went on, and I realized that we spent so much time, so much waste. Like there was a point where, you know, we put movies into development. The story I always tell everybody is that when I put a movie into development, you basically make a list. So we would like buy the rights to a book. And then, you know, when you buy the rights to the book, it's like, oh, somebody's going to adapt this into a screenplay. So then you make a list and there's like 10 names that the studio will actually hire. Right. And then they're never available. Right. so then it's like the same thing for every other role, for a director, for cast, you got to put the movie together, but no one's ever available because the studio is always very, averse, you know, risk averse. You don't get fired for doing what everybody else had done, and everybody has worked their ass off to get into this business and busted down doors. And like, once you get there, nobody wants to get fired, right? And so I had this like moment where I just looked down at all these lists and I said, you know, this entire creative economy in Hollywood is based off of only making job offers to people who have lots of other job offers. And I was like, you know, and I'm going back to my economics degree. I'm like, that doesn't work. You know, you got a real demand.
You go back to economics 101 for that one. Yeah.
I'm like, all right, thanks for that one. I got that. And, you know, but at the same time, I knew all these people who were so passionate about what they wanted to do. And YouTube had come around and the tools were in people's hands and everybody can start to do it. And I just said, you know, there's got to be a way to get up and coming talent who's passionate, who wants the opportunity, into a system where, you know, they can get hired and they can develop. And these things had always existed, like, especially in the entertainment, like in the 70s, they had Roger Corman, who's like, okay, well, here's $1 million, go make this movie and figure it out. And so I really wanted to develop that. I really wanted to develop
that's an interesting
that gave people their shot.
Yeah. That's an interesting way to think about it. Like, yeah, like you're looking for the talent and you're going to give them the money to go and like figure it out, and then you're going to give them the support structure to like make it happen, but in a way that was so, as you described, centralized, It was all in one geography, essentially, or like a few, but a lot of that's in Hollywood.
It's like one zip code. There are literally gates around all these things. Yeah. You know, it's like it's as centralized as you can be.
Completely. And so like now, if we think about 2023, people working from all over the place, there's creative people just putting stuff on the internet, standing out in their own ways. And so, yeah, this is definitely right up my alley in terms of like what I care about as well. Before we get to the actual like aha kind of moment with the beginning of the company, what was your kind of like last job within before you moved into what you're doing now? Oh, because you had another company, I think, or something as well, right?
Yes. So I had gone from being the assistant to running the company. And, you know, we had a lot of really exciting projects happening, and it was really, really, it was exciting, but then there was like nothing happening. And I had this revelation that I was like, I want to find a way to start to get up and coming talent on these projects. So my friends, Mark and Rob and I decided, look, we're going to start a company. It's going to be an entertainment company. And the whole point of the company is that we're going to give writers who I couldn't get hired at Paramount their shot to develop something. So, and that's actually really interesting that you brought that up. The key to all that, though, was like, we need to own something that has some cachet to it, some value, right? And one thing led to another, and we went out and we were able to license the archive of the National Lampoon.
Oh, no way.
So, and I had known the editor over there, and you know, and what I realized going back to like my childhood love of all these like ridiculous 80s kind of Harold Ramis and all these, you know, 80s comedies and stuff, was that every name in comedy wrote for the National Lampoon. Like the, you know, Michael O'Donoghue, who was the first head writer of Saturday Night Live, was the editor of National Lampoon. And then like from Larry David to, you know, you name it, they all contributed to National Lampoon. And there was, you know, moments like the movie Vacation, which I brought up earlier, right? So there's National Lampoon's Vacation. It started out as an article in the magazine. And literally the articles, it starts off and it says, it would have been the best vacation ever if Dad didn't shoot Walt Disney in the leg.
Yeah. Right. What a great line.
And so John Hughes wrote that article.
Yeah.
You know, the famous, and so he could win because when he wrote for the National Lampoon as well, and that became the movie, and you know, Warner Bros. Was doing that in the early, late 70s and early 80s. And that to me was like, wow, there's something there, right? That was what I really wanted to get my hands on, which was, you know, like something really funny, really, really true. And then somebody who's passionate and young enough and really wanted to bring it into the world. Right. And so that's really the road we went down.
You mentioned there, you got the rights to it, you said.
Yeah.
What does that mean for someone who's not from that world? Like, cause I know people talk about getting the rights to, you know, a cartoon, and then they can use it in different worlds, like create merch, and or they can create a digital game out of it or something like that. So what does that kind of process look like, and where did you kind of come up with that as a, why was that such an important part of what you're trying to do?
Well, it was important because it had this asset base, which was, you know, articles that had been written by John Hughes and, you know, Larry David or whomever, right? So we knew that there was something there, and the brand still really meant something to, I think, a generation. So we thought, all right, this is, we can develop out of this. And I knew that we needed, like, to me, like, entertainment business is always about having something, you know, having something that everybody else can, that's easier to market, that has some cachet and some value to it, and telling the right story. So we went after that, and that actually helped us raise money to go do that. So that was the first time I ever actually raised real money in my life.
Got
it. So it was, okay, we're gonna raise money. It's like friends and family. We're gonna go out, raise enough money to go and get the rights to this thing and get this company off the ground. And that was really my first, you know, entrepreneurial journey. But the most important thing about all this, though, is that in that process, one of the people that I ran into who was an investor in that company was this guy named Jack Hughes, who was a hugely successful technology entrepreneur in the first internet wave, and then built an organization called Topcoder, which was a community of software developers way ahead of its time, doing like crazy shit for NASA and IBM and all that. And they had organized a really large community of software developers doing complex things. And at some point, you know, he and I had a conversation which started off as like, you know, like over a beer or whatever. And it was like, hey, you know, I totally believe in what you're trying to do here. I see it. You should really think about what I'm trying to do here with communities online. And if you can combine those two things, I'd write the first check. And that's how Tongo was born. I mean, that's literally how it was born. I was like, oh.
So he was the first investor.
Yeah, he was a founding investor. He's a director and is still highly active in the company. And that's awesome, man. It's how it was. So then like I had found him because I went to Boston College and we were looking for ways to raise money and like looking for high net worth individuals so anybody out there listening to this, like use your network if you have to raise money in an early stage, press your network as hard as you can. You know, I remember I probably sent 100 emails to high net worth people who went to Boston College. So
these were cold. These were people you didn't actually know. That's an interesting one. Yeah. And was this on LinkedIn or something, or what? Do you remember where it was?
I got a list from some guy who was working at a hedge fund.
There we go. Okay, that's good. Yeah. I'm glad I asked because I was actually listening to an interview with, it was on Tim Ferriss' show. I love Tim Ferriss. I think he's great. Yeah, I don't actually listen to his podcast as much as I used to, but he had a really famous investor on. His name is escaping me. It was like a few days ago. And he came up in finance and he was talking about getting early distribution of this like, email. Oh, it wasn't email back then. It was like a fax. You know, like nowadays you send a newsletter on Substack. Yeah. Back in the day, you would have like actual letters. And before that, even it was like people would fax out these memos. And he mentioned that as well. Like he got a bunch of phone numbers from the sales team or something. And he made friends of the different banks and then eventually started putting out there. But I want to come back to that. That point you just made there about, you know, 100 emails is something I've talked a lot about on the show and even in my own personal life. Just those proactive actions, right? Like there's plenty of things we could spend 3 hours about luck and, you know, all the different things that like we're born with and, you know, all those good things that we can't control, which I 100% accept and agree they all exist, right? Like the fact me and you are speaking English, I was born in London, you're born in the States. We were smart enough to go to certain schools. Like that is obviously a lot of luck, like that we didn't, put any work into. But then there's all the other stuff that you said, okay, I've got what I've got now. These are my cards. Now what do I do with it? And I just think even just for my own personal life, I can connect the dots, as we said, to me sending out cold emails. It was about 2010 or 11. I had an idea for a company. I was still working at Google. And I basically said, I need a technical co-founder. I'm not like a software developer. And I did the same thing. I just went on LinkedIn, found my college, Imperial College London. Yeah. I used the keyword founder because I was curious about people that had started stuff at school, essentially, or like at some point in their careers, even if they weren't doing it now. And then I did like computer science or something. And now I still speak to about 7 of the 10 people I emailed that day. And from that time, I've like made other friends. They've introduced me to their, you know, their family members and like became really good friends with. I've had guests on the show that came from that one night when I was in my bedroom being like, I need to take some proactive action. I'm definitely a big fan of doing anything like that. When you have something that you're actually trying to do, I think sometimes people can aimlessly just be like, I need to network with people. And, you know, sometimes that can be a bit of a distraction because you're trying to, you might need to spend that time figuring out what you're actually, you know, should be spending your time on.
Well, I mean, without sounding, you know, like I live in Southern California, if you stand in your own truth, and you you put the effort in, you will begin to attract the right energy back to you. Yeah. I mean, I'll put it this way. Tongle exists because of a cold email, because I was doing, because I, that my passion came through in that. Like I said, I got probably rejected by, or not even responded to by 99 people. I got one person responded to me and that was Jack. That turned into a company. Our biggest customer is Lego. It came from a cold email. From a cold email. And just like, if you're doing something right and you really get your message in front of somebody, you will find the other people who that idea resonates with.
Completely.
It's a fascinating thing about the world we live in is that exists, you know?
100%, Matt. Well, and again, this sounds very tactical, but I'm just curious because even reading, you know, having spoken to you only for less than an hour, reading your LinkedIn and spending a few hours doing research on what you're doing, I can tell, and obviously your love of film, I know story is a big part of what you care about, right? Me too. But you're probably even on a way higher level of like understanding story than I am. So I'm curious to, because when you're writing a cold email, you don't necessarily think about this is the story I'm telling. You think, you know, especially nowadays, people are like, oh, I need to learn copywriting and I need to be able to, you know, hook them with this. And that in a way is a story. But I'm curious, like, what made your cold emails stand out in the same way your letter or whatever it was got you that first job? I'm curious, are there certain things you think about when you're sending that cold email to someone?
Well, I mean, I think if I'm going to send somebody, I mean, this may not be the best strategy. If I'm going to spend, if I'm going to bother somebody I don't know, I better have a good reason, right? Yeah. I'm not going to send spam out. And so if I have a good reason for it, I think my personality is going to come through in that email, right? And I also am not afraid, like, maybe also to a fault, I'm not highly, you know, buttoned up and corporate, and I'm going to be myself. And I don't, if you don't want me, then
it's not going to work anyway.
Bad idea, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm just not the cookie cutter founder executive type. So I think just being myself and being honest and having a real reason to connect with somebody is how you get success out of that.
Like, I agree, man.
Yeah. We had thought a lot about Lego, you know, a lot of what was going on before, you know, making that sort of attack. And then sometimes it's always like, you know, I would also highly recommend working your network, you know, as a system of connection points, right? So if there's somebody you want to talk to, you know, it is like the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever. If there's somebody you really want to talk to, there's probably someone in your network that can at least get you one step closer to that conversation. So if you can't get whoever you want on the phone, like measured steps to get there is.
Yeah,
is,
completely. All right, that was a good little tangent there. I'll bring us great back one into what I had to ask. But so we kind of talk about the initial idea, and you saw this opportunity, and I think I want to just go into that a little bit deeper. So you saw, having spent a lot of time there, as I've seen you describe it, like essentially this amount of money, lots of money going into a small number of creators or, you know, the talent, essentially talent.
And I didn't see that serving the audience over time, but the audience wanted, you know, and then if you look at the product, there just became a lot of sameness, a lot of like, oh, this, you know, and look at Hollywood now, it's all superhero remakes, reboots, you know, and that's what's successful. And that's not what I really wanted to do. So I thought the product was suffering because of the highly centralized distribution ran the business.
Lack of diversity as well.
Lack of diversity.
I don't mean just diversity in terms of like, you know, race and gender, though obviously that is a part of it, but just in terms of like different ideas and people, like someone growing up in Thailand who's a really, you know, talented, creative person just has a completely different life experience to Bilal in New York. Right. Yeah. So it's just, I that's what I mean by diversity, not just those two.
I mean, more than half the people in the entertainment business grew up in New York or Southern or LA. I mean, that's because they have the network in place where that is a real reality for them, where they know people and it's more common. Right. Well, that was a huge driving. I was like, well, wait a minute. Like, there's no geographic diversity. There's no ethnic diversity. There's no gender diversity. Like literally when I started Tongo, 5% of women, 5% of directors in Hollywood were women.
Do you know what it is now?
It's like, I think above 30, which is getting there.
Yeah.
You know, but it was so male dominated. So I'm like, well, that's not the audiences. The audiences, even just from take the virtuous motivation out of all this. Well, just from a pragmatic standpoint, well, the audience is made up of lots of people too.
Yeah, of course.
Like
it's
not, you know, so like just this idea that, you know, certain people were going to be the culture makers. And that's, you know, since then it's just completely been blown up, that idea, which 100%. Which is awesome.
Well, it's moving in that direction at least. Yeah, for sure.
You know, so I'm like, oh, we're going down this road and, you know, wanted to have a business right away. And I knew that the entertainment space was full of minefields and we didn't really have any money to go and build something. So it was like, all right, well, along those lines, I discovered advertising and I was like, holy shit. Like, wait a minute. Like, and it was the film business, but worse. we're just going to make really expensive 30-second films for TV that nobody actually wants to watch. You know what I mean? At least in the entertainment people will exchange their money or a subscription to watch your product. And you know, most advertising people are like,
this is just being shoved down people's throats.
In fact, we'll pay to put this in front of you. So,
yeah.
So I was like, well, you know, geez, I don't think that, like, and just being aware of, I'm watching less, you know, television at the time. And I'm like, all right, well, this, once the internet just completely just, you know, levels everything. And it just continues to do that. Right. So, you know, once the genie was out of the lamp of the audience having choice and freedom, that was over. Right. And still outside of sports and live events, it's largely over. Right.
Yeah. Completely.
So I was like, all right, well, I think there's a real need for advertisers to start to make content for YouTube and social media. So let's just kind of start there. And that's like, that's literally how the business got started. You know, we had a couple customers early on, you know, it felt great to get that first check,
all 100%. That stuff. So I want to hear all about how you got your first customers and scaling up. We're just going to take a quick break here for a second, and we'll be back after this short message from the sponsors. Focus on driving your business forward and leave your remote talent search to Virtual Gurus, a trusted virtual assistant platform in North America. They connect you to remote admin assistants at highly affordable rates with flexible monthly subscriptions. All of the assistants are pre-vetted, skilled, and based in the US and Canada, so you can delegate tasks reliably whenever you need the help. Whether it's one assistant or multiple, Virtual Gurus has you covered with a wide range of services, from bookkeeping and marketing support to data entry and admin tasks, to sales support, calendar management, a lot more. They also have a strong social mission to provide meaningful work opportunities for underrepresented communities, so you'll benefit from an incredibly diverse talent pool. Best of all, Virtual Gurus is highly affordable and saves you 40% on traditional hiring costs. So if you're looking for talented remote staff on a budget, book a free consult at thevirtualgurus.com/creator. That's thevirtualgurus.com/creator. Now let's get straight back to the show. All right, welcome back. So we were just talking about sponsors, and I had to big up the sponsor for the show there, which is a nice, funny transition. But let's get back to getting your first customers. You mentioned cold emails changing your life in many different ways. Yeah. Talked about cold email getting Lego once upon a time. But I want to actually go to the first few customers you got, because this is something where 14 years later, you see a company that's working with all these brands. People don't realize that what it took to get the first few, and getting the first few often is like the hardest ones in many ways, because you have less to, you know, social proof to sell and say, hey, we're already working with Lego and we're working with XYZ. So do you remember the first few and how you actually got those?
Oh, completely. So, I mean, I'll never forget. So the first few brands on Tongle, we paid for, we put the money up. There was a lot of young filmmakers we knew were like, okay, you gotta sign up for this. You know, the irony of Tongle is I had to go out and pay money, like a lot of money, to make an animation to explain it. And then ultimately we built this insane community of animators. I had to go like a great company, but I had to go like a more traditional route. So we started to get people to the what I would call the supply side of our market. And so we knew we had people in there. And then, I was like, oh, we got to get a brand on here. We got to do something relevant. And one of my best friends, he was an early employee at a company called Vineyard Vines. You're probably familiar with them.
Yeah, right.
Like ties and like vests and like very, very big with like the New England set, you know, but then they've also built an awesome business, just an awesome, awesome business. And I was like, listen, dude, like I'll put the money up. You guys need some videos on your YouTube channel. We'll put the money up to our community and we'll do something really fun. Like, you know, how do you tie a tie? Cause it was, you know, you put your Google hat on, you're like, oh, that's an awesome, you know, search phrase that you'd want videos around at some point. And so we're like, all right, well, let's just do that. And so that was the very first, what I'd call like real project on top of Tongle was we operated it very differently back then. It was really a contest to make videos about tying your tie. And I remember sitting around watching them come through the platform, like, holy shit, like people are actually doing this and they're good. Like, and they're funny. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. And so that was really the first, you know, thing. And the best part about that is I know a lot of people, if they're on an entrepreneurial journey, they're like, well, when do you know to hire somebody? The first employee of Tongle, Caleb Lightwill, is still with the company. He was one of the, and just an awesome guy. And he had been in the community, and he made one of those videos that had been purchased by Vineyard Vines. And then at some point he wrote me like a note saying, same thing, cold email, wrote me a note being like, hey, you know, if you might remember me from this video, I moved out to LA and my job blew up. And I'm wondering if there's any chance, like, I could come work with you. And like, boom, like that's, you know, same thing. That's what happened. So that was the first like real project. And that was, you can see how definitive these things you do early on can be in your future in a way, right?
And do you remember roughly how big that initial project was? I guess it's a lot of this kind of public knowledge.
$5,000.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to ask, because a lot of it's like out there, I guess, on when people are bidding for stuff. So 5K, is that quite a typical size for what you guys have now? Or is it, I'm sure there's such a crazy range.
It's just not typical, right? There's things that are like lightweight TikTok into hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Massive
for
project.
Animation. Yeah, so it's, there's no one typical thing. But I'd say a lot of things are in that range. But that was for, you know, a group of videos. So we really, it was a way to kickstart the community.
Yeah,
I do think like online communities, they have this, they're like a culture in a way where it's like, and by culture, I mean like almost like a sourdough starter or something like that, where it's like you need an early group of people to kick it off. And then so long as you keep feeding it, it continues to grow. You know,
they're like the
core. But nothing ever goes away.
Yeah, completely. Right. I got you. And so like, you know, obviously in startup world, we use the phrase product market fit. There's we've done many episodes on that in the past. Yeah. But at what point did you start to say, okay, this is really working? Because I know like that first initial, you know, you see money come through the door. And actually, sorry, I should clarify, from that 5K, did you guys just take a percentage, I assume, as the platform?
We paid for it. We paid
you,
for
you
it.
Paid for
I
that
went
one.
To
okay.
my buddy, I'm like, look, I'll put $5,000 for you to test this out.
Got it. Sorry, you did say that.
And that's actually a really, you know, for entrepreneurs listening, like I it's a good way to get past the bullshit. Put a little bit of your own money at stake if you're doing something like this.
To rephrase it, that was the initial, but the way it works now, when a brand like Lego is paying for, let's say, a 100K project, and you're, you know, lots of creators are being paid out through that, obviously, I'm assuming you guys take, you know, some sort of cut in the middle or something like that?
Yeah, we act like almost like an agent to the creators. So we take
a cut of
what they make, and then we also charge our partners a monthly fee to be a member of our community.
Awesome. Yeah. And we probably should have said that at the beginning of the show, but just so we didn't miss it for people listening.
That's evolved quite a bit, you know.
Yeah.
In the early days,
well, I was going to say, because a lot of the time
things on the wall and figuring it out.
Yeah. And a lot of the time people will start with essentially like, especially in creative work, you start with essentially an agency model or something like that, right? Or a production company style model. Like you're being paid to do a bunch of work. Or in my world, in advertising, it was, oh, you're going to be paid to manage X. But over time, people evolve and they say, actually, well, I don't want to just be the person who's doing the work every time. I'm going to find a way to, maybe I'm going to outsource this. I'm going to hire more people, get freelancers or whatever. So as you kind of thought about those different stages, I'm curious to understand that feeling of product market fit. And the reason I say that is because there's like academic, you know, startup book versions of what product market fit is, and then there's actually what it's like in practice. So I'm curious, like, for you, when it started clicking, where you said, actually, this version of what we're doing is working and is completely different to what's out there. Like, how early was that?
I know the exact moment it happened. It was, I mean, and I would say the early phase, right before it became like real, you know, when we knew that the community was going to work. The site went live in the summer of 2009. That's kind of when that Vineyard Vines thing happened. And it was really like, you know, in us working with a couple different companies too. So we had got like, I remember being like, first we had to put the money up ourselves. And then the, like, I remember, you know, the company LendingTree.
Yeah, I do.
They put the money up. That was the next step. It was like, okay, now we don't have to put the money up ourselves anymore.
Okay, we didn't do it ourselves. Yeah.
And that was 10 grand. And we're like, holy shit, $10,000. You know, it's like, I couldn't even imagine, you know, more money going to this thing, which is just, you know, just crazy. And at the end of that year, are you familiar with Kiva, the micro lending?
Kiva.org. Yeah, great. I've actually given money to them. And I used to work at a place after Google called Charity Water, and they were kind of in a similar bucket in that world, like the forward thinking nonprofits. But yeah, Kiva are awesome.
So they wanted a video that explained how Kiva worked. And so we did the same process. And when the community members came back, a guy who I had no, like, at some point there was that one degree of Kevin Bacon between, you know, us and, you know, everybody who was either in the community or was, you know, sponsor or whatever, like my friend from Vineyard Vines or whatever, right? Well, the best video that came out of that was done by a guy. It was like, I remember it was December 21st, the shortest day of the year. It was, he was literally in the Arctic Circle in Sweden where he was doing it from. And that was the best video. And I had no personal connection to this person whatsoever. He just found Tongle, found our community. Kiva loved it. And the video wound up on the homepage of YouTube. So right then and there, I'm wait a minute. Like, we can do this. That was like, this is possible. Like, there's some dude who's really talented who we really don't have any connection to. He's doing this amazing work.
That's incredible.
It's working and an audience is reacting to it.
Yeah.
So that was just like, that was a lightning in a bottle kind of a thing. I'm like, all right, now we can really get serious about this. This isn't like a skunk works anymore.
Yeah, completely. Now, I'm glad I asked that because you're,
there is a
certain thing where sometimes it's progressive and it's just like, okay, things are getting a little bit better. But to other people I speak to, it's like, no, this moment of clarity, like, oh wow, that, and it often isn't the idea you initially had often as well. It's like this rough idea and then it kind of just like manifests in a certain way. Maybe with yours it was actually the idea, actually. So interesting that it was that clear. And so, like, moving forward from there, obviously you've been around for 13-14 years by this point. You know, a lot of startups, you raise that initial amount of money from the guy that you mentioned. And then I'm assuming at some point you had to go and get some more money because you're hiring people and getting an office and doing all the things that are needed to grow. It looks like you got to Series D, which is a very mature, startup. A lot of companies never even get to that size. So I'm curious, like, if you were thinking of the 14 years, the different kind of categories of growth, because I'm sure the first couple years are so different to the way things are now. And what was important as a leader in that company? That's kind of the lens I'm looking at, because a lot of people who start a company aren't the same people who run it way down the line. And you've been there since the beginning. So I'm curious, like, what your learnings have been growing with the company as it's evolved.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, you got to be flexible. And you know, if they say you're going to get the trip you need, not the trip you want, you got to be flexible and know that
there's a Southern California coming at you again.
But my expectations have changed both in what was possible and what could happen at what timeline. Like, I think I think what's allowed me to be successful and, you know, kind of push through any, you know, like, we're fortunate enough that, like, Tongle is both pioneer and settler of this creator space, right? Like I said, now going back to the beginning, like, we didn't have words for that. Like, people didn't really saying creator. They weren't talking about, like, communities really at the time. And so just being, like, having the patience and steadfastness to say, all right, like, you're going to have good days, you're going to have terrible days, and you just got to find a way to get through it all. And know that you need to evolve as the market. And so, like, for us to have been so early, the company went through lots of experimentations with its revenue models and how it was going to operate and how the projects were going to flow on the site. And, like, how, so, like, just being open and willing to evolve your vision to meet, like, the reality is, I think, really, really important. So we stretched that seed round out. I mean, it was a tiny seed round, we stretched it out because we went out and built a business. So we started to have customers, which is the best thing, best advice to anyone who wants to start a business, get customers.
Yeah. And you had revenue from day one, pretty much. So it wasn't a business where you're saying, oh, well, we're going to figure that out at a point in the future. You could see straight away, okay, people are transacting here. So meaning like money is being exchanged. So there's always going to be a way to make money in that scenario.
So we stretched, we called it a Series A, it was really a seed round. And we stretched that out until the beginning of 2013, which is the first time we raised any institutional venture capital. And it was, we almost like skipped a step because remember there was, a really, really big firm came in. There's still investors in the company, Insight out of New York. And they saw it and, there was 8 people in the company. at the time. So
how many people are there now?
We have 48.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And that's still quite lean for the size. Because I know even just the support, 160,000, creators and stuff like that, and the number of brands you work with, that's quite impressive. And I say that in a good way, by the way. It's not because some people are like, oh, I want more employees because it makes you feel good. But in this case, it's like lean is good for me. So
without trying to be a cliche, I am trying to build the organization of the future. I am trying to build the studio of the future. So, so our product has been built, remotely or however you want to look at it forever. And so the more things that, like, for example, our YouTube channel, community members run it. We may oversee it or whatever, but we hand, like, so our Instagram, all social media content, we kind of, we let our community members oversee that stuff and do it because, it would either be we would have to hire the people to do that, or since we have a creator community, well, why don't we let them do it? So it seems very authentic for us to do that,
right?
So like we try to do as much as we can via the community as possible.
Got it. Yeah. And so we're going to switch gears a little bit here because I could speak to you for a lot longer on things that helped you grow and stuff like that. But before we get to kind of the future and how Hollywood's evolving and entertainment, just on the growth side though, like we talked about the initial customers you got in and how you might have changed your revenue model over time. But were there a few key moments where you said, oh, that really took us to another level? And I know you mentioned Lego was kind of like a dream client for you guys or a dream brand to have in your ecosystem. So I'm curious, were there a few moments where you're like, okay, that really just took us to another level, whether that was like revenue, which is obviously a really important thing here, or if it was getting certain types of creators or partnering with someone. Just curious what those growth levers look like for you.
It was probably like 3 or 4 moments over the course of the business's journey. Sometimes that happens in a very compressed timetable for people. I think that that's not the norm. Right. So, looking back on it, you get romanced by, everybody talks about whatever this company, how much money this company raised or whatever stupid valuation and all that. And that's not the normal business. Right. You're starting a business because you want to do it for a long time. And so for us, there were like definitely a few really key moments. Like the business really got its first wave of growth via Lego and Procter & Gamble. Those were the first two businesses that really, really adopted this and started to operate with our community. I remember there was a moment where once Lego agreed to do this, we were sitting in a restaurant in New York and got an email with 10 briefs from the guy who were working at Lego for the community. And it was, all this exciting stuff. And right then I was like, wow, that's really something. So
Do you remember what year that was, by the way?
It was
roughly
the beginning of 2012, I want to say.
The reason is because I was working at Google then, and my team were the managed Lego in my old team.
Oh,
so
really?
It wasn't my account, but there were, I think maybe there's a girl called Megan, I think maybe worked on it. And Mike Burke, who was he's the head of the vertical there. I remember we would always look at Lego as an example. People would always use it as an example of doing interesting work.
Yeah. Oh, and so it was just, we knew it was sort of on right there. That was a big, big moment. Got it. So once that happened, yes, yeah, so that had to be the beginning of 2012. That set us up between that and Procter & Gamble. That had set us up for, you know, real growth to the point where I think we were, you know, we probably doing, we when we brought in institutional, you know, we're probably gonna do like $4 million that year. You know, that got us from basically really kind of like $0 to $4 million over the course of so Tongo really launched in South by Southwest 2010. You know, that was when it really kind of, so from that moment to 2000, basically zero to 2012, you know, we're probably doing about a $4 million run rate by the end of 2012 on all that. And so that was really a big step. Right. And then there was another wave of growth that followed the institutional investment, you know, burned a lot of money to get it. I'm not going to lie to you, you know, but it helped get the company to some form of scale. And we still had it, you know, in my book, whenever I write the book, you know, we just didn't have the thing right yet. Like we didn't have the revenue model right. We knew it was getting product market fit, but we didn't have it right. And it just took a couple of years to figure all that out. So there was that wave of growth. Then there was like a wave of growth, which took us to some meaningful scale. And then it was pretty flat for a while we figured it out.
Yeah. In the 2010s, you mean?
No, this is like late 2017, 18.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
Yes. So like the first wave of growth, I would say, you know, got us to 2012. From 2012 to 2013 to 16, there was another decent step up in terms of growth. Then it just kind of, we didn't have it right. So we kind of had we had to tinker a little bit. You know, things changed. And, you know, I kind of really stepped in and said, look, we're going to have to think about how we sell to customers. We got to think about the biggest thing I learned, and I've done like this great, like there's literally a Harvard Business School case study on this. I'm like, and it's hilarious to watch because it's like you live through it. But that process actually helped me figure out what the right operating model was, what the right way to charge people was and all that.
Yeah.
We had to, I guess, you know, we really had to figure it out right in that phase. And then, so in, you know, late, you know, 2018, 2019, started to transition the revenue model. And then that gave us this last wave of growth. So like we, you know, it's been like, oh, okay. And then you're like, kind of like,
and so that was the, so that's interesting. Cause one was about getting big brands. One, I'm sure, and then from there, I'm sure you like, and also raising money, you could hire probably salespeople and other people helping the growth. That's more of a traditional thing, right? The interesting one we just said there about pricing model being kind of a lever there. So could you explain what was it before and what did it change to and why you think that made such a big difference?
Yeah, I mean, originally it was project-based, like you said, like you're saying, like, you know, we go and we'd say, you pay us X number of dollars and we'll be able to deliver this many videos to you. Right. And part of like the Harvard case study, I had like another revelation. It was like probably one of the two or three biggest business revelations in my life where I'm like, holy shit, our revenue model it's not differentiated from any competition. Right. Cause if you're, you know, agency can price things this way or a big production company could price things this way. And the incentive system's broken because as a business, my personal incentive is to try to charge Procter & Gamble as much money as I can, as much money as they'll pay me. And then when you think about it, my incentives were to keep as much of that money as possible in terms of margin. And then whatever I can do to get the job done. And that was a big, big mistake.
Yeah.
Big mistake.
Right? So just to clarify, you're saying so the incentive is to get the most money, but then essentially do the least amount of work. Is that kind of what you mean?
Or the incentive is to your delivery system, which in our case was a community. You pay the least amount. We were a very mission driven company, so we never really exploited anybody in those terms. Yeah. Which you can see a lot of like venture capitalists sitting around being like, you know, you know, this should be cheaper and all that. But like if you think about it, if you started a t-shirt business or whatever, you'd want to manufacture the t-shirts for as little as you could.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's a very,
so I get you. Okay. So you're saying that was a mistake in a way though.
I think it was a big mistake because it didn't align our incentives with the customer and the community. And I think the way we've evolved is that now everyone's incentives are fully aligned. Right. So that's made a big difference. And so part of like switching the revenue model gave us the growth. It gave us the right incentives, kept customers around.
And sorry, just to clarify, just in case I missed it, and to be super clear, the model changed now because you said it was project based. And then what did it actually change to though?
It moved to platform subscription based.
Got it. Okay.
Over time, and so there was a little bit of like changing the. Whatever the lame analogy is, changing the engine out while the plane's in the air or whatever.
Yeah.
So that, you know, is really what has happened.
So that means the brands are paying.
So
the brands are paying a monthly fee and they get like credits or something like that.
They get a membership to Tongle. They get project management across their, and they get unlimited access to the community. And then it's consumption based. So we've designed it so that that price never changes for the customer. And they can really scale into it. So it's really a nice mix. And again, if something should cost $5,000, our team is incentivized to be like, that's what it should cost. If it should cost more, they're not in the middle of that kind of pricing anymore.
Yeah, so you've taken the price out of
pricing.
It.
Yeah.
Got it. So that makes sense.
That was a really big learning for me.
Also for you guys, it's more predictable in terms of revenue, right? So you can plan around that better, because when you've got anything project based, I mean, I felt this at Charity Water actually. Fun fact for you is that episode 2 of this podcast was with the founder of Charity Water, Scott Harrison. And then a year or two later, I ended up leaving my job and joining them full time. And we talked about the Spring, which was a monthly giving subscription, in the interview. And then when I got there, I saw firsthand what would happen, because for a business, going up and down in revenue is really tough, but for a nonprofit, it's way harder, because you're actually trying to deliver something. You're not just having money in the bank. You're trying to take that money and build, you know, really complex water systems around the world in the developing world. So if you can predict that revenue more easily and more accurately, it makes your life 10 times better, and you can do a lot better work.
So you can really build and plan a business.
Exactly. You know? You can hire the right people and know and project that out properly.
And the project-based thing, it has its attractiveness, because check sizes can be bigger. It's faster sales cycle, because people can just say yes. And people are like allergic to ongoing things sometimes. But I have to say, there's so many hidden costs in a project-based system, because you got to resell everything. You need a lot of salespeople. You need to make sure that, this was a really smart, in my opinion, transition for the business, because it got us more ingrained in customers.
That makes more sense.
Trade at some point, you know?
Yeah. And so just for the last part of the show, thanks for sharing all that.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the future now, because you've come from Hollywood, you know that world really well. You obviously have a love for parts of it, in the nostalgia and the classic stuff, but you've also got this, your foot in the future and technology and what's going on. So I'm interested to understand where you think things are going. And maybe a question to frame this around is, we're in 2023, let's look to the end of the decade, right? Where do you think the world is going to be in terms of how media and advertising and how this is all going to be working, as it relates to, compared to what it's like today?
Yeah. I mean, to me, it is inevitable that the audience and the creator merge, right? So, all of the things that were used to being its own entity, the studio, the brand, the advertising agency, it's all going to merge. The audience is going to have to be meaningfully involved with the people creating the content that they're consuming. And that's going to be very, very disruptive to all these, sort of legacy systems that are out there. Like, it's just this, because if you think about, like I said, earlier, an advertising agency is really organized. It's organized, it's profitable when it's making very expensive 30-second commercials for television, right? Movie studio, the creative days are kind of in a lot of ways behind everybody. Right, where it's like, really, it's functioning as a finance distribution and marketing mechanism. And you know, most of the studios aren't good at any of those, right? So now that, you know, I can, you know, talk to ChatGPT and write something immediately, not that that's what I think should happen, but now that those tools are in everybody's hands, I just think that the ability, virtual production backgrounds, the Unreal Engine, all these things are in everybody's hands now. The individual can be the sophisticated creator again. So we're really trying to organize the systems around all that.
Got it.
So I think that the biggest disconnect is I'm trying to do something. I think that this is what the audience wants, right? And then so really bringing those things together, the creator and audience is where everything is, in my opinion, everything's going that way.
Yeah.
And the businesses that understand that are going to win, and those that don't are just not. They're just going to get left behind. Just going to get left behind because, you know, there's such a, and look, I mean, it was, you know, last 2 years, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. But the funny thing is, like, all the systemic issues I saw in Hollywood when I started my career, cost of production is too high. The audience is completely disconnected from the creative. And like those chickens have sort of come home to roost in the sense that, you know, Netflix is $20 billion in debt. I mean, $20 billion. And it's all because they're to finance content, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Disney, it doesn't end. Like, everyone thought Disney Plus was going to, you know, the savior, and it's just not. And so, and at the root of it is, it costs too much money to make this stuff because of the system it's getting made at, and because of risk aversion in that system. So the second you can break that open is when things really start to change. And again, at the end of the decade, the people who have traditionally given up their economic rights in all this stuff, and I would say that's the audience, the creators, by and large, all creators. So like, you know, if you're the camera operator in a movie, you have no economic incentive in the product, right? And then in a funny way, the brand's given up all economic rights to content because they've, you know, forever gone out and exchanged money to intercept, you know, to interrupt, you know, whatever TV show and put their 30 seconds of film in it. Well, guess what the network is doing? They're taking that money and they're using it to invest in Seinfeld or whatever it is. Yeah. Well, guess who's financing that?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So those three things coming together, to me, I think that's going to be really, really interesting when that happens.
Yeah.
The audience is buying their Netflix subscription. They don't own, you know, Wednesday.
Yeah.
Netflix and Tim Burton own Wednesday. So well, great. So, but I gave you all this money. So like that's where I think we're going. I think those things are going to merge.
It's interesting because you mentioned ChatGPT and you started talking about Netflix being in debt. And the next two things I had to close us out was going to be AI and streaming wars. So perfect transition there. I just want to dig into that in a little bit more detail. So the AI side on Creator Lab, we've done a few episodes. The last few episodes have been on AI because it's the hot thing right now.
Yep.
And I have a second podcast called Not Investment Advice where we've done a bunch of episodes on it too. You mentioned ChatGPT writing, which is a tool which people haven't used or played around with. It's kind of like a chat bot and you can ask it questions and it can actually, instead of just Google giving you the answer, it can actually write the answer for you and stuff like that. So it's really pretty cool tool. But there's also tools that have video, audio, images, all being generated by this AI. So as it relates to what, you know, your industry is doing, creative, you know, visuals, video, you know, all multimedia essentially. What's your opinion on how AI is actually going to impact that in terms of replacing people? And I don't mean literally no one's working. I just mean, Do you think there are certain tasks or types of work that are more susceptible to being taken over by some of these tools?
For sure. But my personal opinion is, to the extent that AI becomes a tool for creative people to bring their vision into the world, I think it's beneficial, right?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, again, we're all human beings. We can bring things into the world. And, you know, look, I to the extent that it helps me realize my vision, technology is great, right? I can't draw. I can't draw. Not, a little bit. Not really great. I have terrible hair. But to the extent that I had a tool that could help me express what I wanted to, That's really helpful. I think the real secret, though, is me being able to work with the person that can do it, the human being that can do it. So I think to the extent that AI can like really help with storyboards in my business, right? It can help with reviewing, you know, creative submissions in a way, right? It can help us learn from what people are doing and saying. That's really exciting to me. So, you know, I think the biggest thing that's starting to come into focus right now is, you know, AI might be the largest class action lawsuit to ever exist.
Yeah.
You know, because ultimately we're just scraping over everybody else's stuff and selling it to somebody else. And at some point, like it's, you know, you think about what's actually happening is you're taking other people's images and words and text and repackaging it. I think that there's, you know, landmark legal case around all this stuff at some point, right?
Yeah, we're gonna need another 2-hour episode for that one, but yeah. No, I know what you're saying. Well, it's definitely very early, and you're right, like that is happening as we speak. So really it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I know we only have a couple minutes left, so just to move us on to the last question, really, you mentioned Netflix being in debt. I'm just curious, as someone who's so close to the industry and sees it firsthand, how do you see this playing out in terms of, you know, people call it the streaming wars, but really to me, it's this future of digital media and the platforms that exist. So we've got on one side, the streamers like Netflix and, you know, HBO, you know, even though they're, you know, HBO has been around for a long time and has this amazing library of content. And then you've got someone like Netflix, which is basically digital only now. And then you've got on the flip side, you've got YouTube and TikTok, who, you know, just are free for people to use. They don't charge money. It's advertising supported, and now subscriptions for YouTube as well. I'm just curious how you see that all evolving for those particular companies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Netflixes are going to struggle. I think that it's inevitable. At some point, you got crazy interest rates. You got a lot of debt. You got, you know, in order to bring your product to market, it's highly expensive. They also don't. And I love Netflix as a customer, but they also don't have, like, they don't have secondary or tertiary monetization of titles yet.
Yeah.
Right. So until there's a Stranger Things Broadway show that grosses, you know, $500 million, and they can meaningfully do that, and there's meaningful, and Stranger Things is probably the biggest Netflix. I know that maybe not the most seen at this point, but definitely from a brand awareness standpoint, definitely the largest Netflix title. And, you know, there's no license business on it. There's no theme park on it. And so even Disney, who's the master who invented that business, is struggling. You would look at Netflix and say, well, I don't know how you're going to not struggle in all this.
Yeah. And you're right. It's just so it's so capital intensive to play that model. And like 10 years ago, I was looking at them and Netflix and YouTube, where I was working at the time. And I would say, oh, I wish YouTube was doing more of what they were doing in a way. I was like, why don't they go and bid? I know this is not what Netflix is doing, but why don't they go and bid for the sports rights, which they're kind of now doing with Amazon and stuff as well. It just felt so obvious that like we were all moving away from live TV, but we still wanted some access to the really good stuff. And YouTube didn't have that at the time. But now, you know, YouTube is really, one of the only places that works.
If YouTube can get the costs under control, I'm pretty long YouTube. I mean, I just kitchen research, what my kids would take YouTube out of 10 if they had free reign to go on YouTube. And now, and by the way, also I've kind of gone to the point where I don't have any kind of traditional. And every once in a while, I'm like, oh, the Giants are playing the Vikings this week or last week, whatever it was. I'm like, I just want to put the TV on. I'm like, it becomes this big struggle to figure it out.
Have you ever used YouTube TV? Because they have the live TV, but like you can stream it as well. So
yeah, that's probably where I'm going. So I am along YouTube. I think that the biggest thing, if Netflix, Disney Plus, you know, HBO Max, whatever, if those studios can't figure out how to continue to monetize their IP in new ways, right? And I think that's very creator focused. These businesses have huge, valuable libraries of content, but because to innovate or to create a product, it's $100 million every time. If there's a new way, let me just throw this crazy out. If someone could figure out a new way to bring quality shit to audiences, right?
Yeah,
that would really be meaningful to studios and streamers. And
that isn't 100 mil a pop. I get you, man.
Yeah. So anyways, that's where we're at.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get you, man. No, I definitely agree. It's a really interesting space, and appreciate your point of view on it, given how close you are to stuff. I know we're hitting time now, so you might have a hard stop here, and I don't want to keep you if you need to go. But the last quick fire question I'll ask is, Do you think TikTok is getting banned in the US at some point this year or in the near future?
This year would be a stretch. In the near future, I could definitely see it.
Really?
And my old friend Ryan Kavanaugh would probably be pretty happy about that. But we'll see.
Awesome, man. Well, listen, thanks again for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. Where can people go check out everything you're doing?
Tongle.com. Yeah.
Tongle.com. Keep it nice and simple. All right. Well, really appreciate it. And if you're ever in New York, make sure you give me a shout. We'll have to do
that
this in person
awesome.
As well.
I would definitely love that.
I want to hear some more of these old Hollywood stories. I know you've got a few.
I got enough. I'll give you the ones that aren't PG when I see it.
Yeah, that's perfect. All right. Well, we'll save that for the Patreon one day. Anyway, man, appreciate you coming on. And I hope everyone listening enjoyed this. Let us know what you think of this on Twitter, as always. And we'll see you in a couple weeks for the next episode. And speak soon. Cheers.
Thanks for having me on.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at bzaidi, B-Z-A-I-D-I, or creatorlabfm on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.